Good day. Today is 19th October 2025. And as usual, let me remind you before I start with the rest of the program, let me remind you to tick the like button. If once you've listened or watched the program or whatever part of the program you want to listen or watch, you've liked what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact, please do so by ticking the like button. Now let's proceed with the substance of this program, and I'm going to say that I'm going to start with the military situation in Ukraine, because we are now getting rather dramatic news from the various battlefronts. Dramatic news which, if fully confirmed, which I expect it will be, by the way, will have undoubtedly a significant bearing on the diplomacy that may be about to take place when Putin and Trump meet in Budapest in a few weeks' time. So the news relates to events on three battlefronts: the Kherson battlefront, the Zaporozhye battlefront, and Pokrovsk. There's been some interesting and important possible developments in other places too, Liman specifically and Kupiansk, but let me first begin with those three places that I've just mentioned. Now, in my program yesterday, I said that reports were circulating that the Russians have crossed the Dnieper and have reoccupied some territory in the city of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper. Kherson is the capital of Kherson region. It is a large city, about 270,000 people before the war. It was captured by the Russians in 2022, about 10 days, I seem to remember, after the start of the special military operation. The Russians rolled in and captured Kherson, and there was no resistance there. Their advance into Kherson city was unopposed. President Zelensky of Ukraine was furious about it. He's at various times blamed the former Ukrainian military chief, General Zaluzhny, for the Russian capture of Kherson city. And at various times, he has held out the possibility of a criminal prosecution against Zaluzhny for permitting Kherson city to fall unopposed to the Russians. I'm not going to get into the details about this. As I remember, at that time, Zaluzhny wasn't even the overall military commander. I believe he had some role to play about the situation in the south of Ukraine. I'm not going to get into the details of this. All I will say is that it was a blow, and a one which Zelensky himself took personally, and which has festered at the back of his mind ever since. Anyway, after a great deal of rumour and speculation that the Ukrainians were going to launch a counteroffensive to recapture the city of Kherson, they eventually did so in August 2022. We now know, thanks to the New York Times, long expose in the New York Times, that the counterattack on Kherson, which was carried out by newly mobilized Ukrainian troops and which followed a very substantial infusion of military aid from the West, to be more precise, from the East European members of NATO, who were at that time supplying Ukraine with Soviet-era tanks and infantry fighting vehicles and artillery, but which was also supported by the United States with the supply of HIMARS missiles launchers. And we also know that the United States was deeply involved in the planning of the Kherson counteroffensive that the Ukrainians undertook in August 2022. Anyway, in August 2022, the Ukrainians conducted a counteroffensive to take Kherson city back. And this counteroffensive ran into many problems. As I very well remember, the Ukrainians suffered very, very heavy losses. And nonetheless, and in spite of that, the Russians, after it became increasingly clear that it would be more and more difficult to keep their forces on the west bank of the Dnieper, supplied through the two bridges in Kherson city, the Antonovsky Bridge and another bridge further to the north, a place called Novaya Kakhovka, a bridge that was laid out over a dam built by the Soviet Union across the Dnieper. Anyway, after the Russians became increasingly concerned about the viability of these bridges and increasingly concerned that their forces on the west bank of the Dnieper defending Kherson city might become marooned, isolated there, the Russians decided to withdraw from Kherson city and withdrew their forces to the east bank of the Dnieper. And from memory, that happened in October 2022. Now, the New York Times has told us that this whole operation was largely planned by the United States, and that the actual objective of that offensive was indeed principally to defeat and destroy Russian forces west of the Dnieper River. The fact that the Russians pulled these forces back in a very well executed withdrawal basically defeated the point of this offensive from an American point of view. But from a Ukrainian point of view, the offensive must be counted a success, because the city of Kherson was recaptured, and from a Russian point of view, the recapture of the city of Kherson was a major embarrassment and one that provoked considerable disquiet, as I remember, in Russia at that time. Anyway, a couple of days ago, reports began to circulate that the Russians had crossed the Dnieper again and were fighting to recapture, or at least were fighting to recapture either all or part of the city of Kherson. And I expressed surprise that this was the case. I said that conducting an amphibious landing in Kherson city across the Dnieper in autumn in bad weather conditions seemed to me a very complicated and risky thing to do. And I said that I would like to see some evidence that this was actually happening. Well, today we have received what might indeed be that evidence, because the governor, the Russian appointed governor of Kherson region, Vladimir Saldo, has just said this to the Russian TASS news agency. "We control part of Kherson, located on the left bank. It is an industrial zone and our forces already control it. A lot of suburban settlements on islands in the Dnieper lower reaches downstream to the Black Sea are also under the control of the Russian army. So the liberation of Kherson has already started." Now, he refers to the left bank, which is the east bank, the Russian-controlled part of the east bank. But reading the rest of this comment, I think that this is probably an error, and I think he's referring to the right bank, in other words, the west bank of the Dnieper, and that it is this bank which he is now suggesting that the Russians have entered and which they now control. A lot of suburban settlements on the islands in the Dnieper lower reaches downstream to the Black Sea are also under the control of the Russian army. This has been clear for some time. The Russians have been methodically regaining control of the islands in the Dnieper. But what Saldo seems to be telling us here is that the Russians have crossed the Dnieper itself and are now fighting in the city of Kherson itself, not in the residential areas or the central areas, but in an industrial zone. And he says that the Russians already control it. Now, that's Saldo. Sometimes Russian officials say more than they know. Denis Pushilin, who is the governor of Donetsk region, the Russian-controlled part of Donetsk region, I should stress. Well, he has on more than one occasion said things that turned out to be, shall we say, exaggerated or ahead of events. But Saldo, in my experience, has generally been pretty accurate about what he says, and what he's saying now is so consistent with all of the other reports about the Russians landing in Kherson and capturing part of the city that I think it is much more likely now that it is true. There may still be a small question mark, and it's possible that the Ukrainians will conduct a counterattack. And bear in mind, it's completely unclear to me how the Russians are going to keep their troops west of the Dnieper, on the west bank of the Dnieper, in Kherson city there, how they're going to keep them supplied. Obviously, they need to send boats with supplies across the Dnieper, but that might be a very complex operation at this time of year. And, well, before long, we're probably going to see ice start to pass down the Dnieper. And at least initially, and probably beyond that, this is going to cause more problems still. But anyway, the long and the short of it, see, is that the Russians do seem to have crossed the Dnieper, established some control of some of the territory on the Dnieper in Kherson city. And well, we'll see how things move on from this point. So that is big news. And given how Zelensky felt about the loss of Kherson city in 2022, one can well imagine his reaction if he discovers that what some Ukrainians believe to have been their biggest victory of the war, the recapture of Kherson city from the Russians in October 2022, if that victory is now in question and that there is a risk that it might be reversed. Anyway, there may be some questions about this, and, well, one would like to see film, and one would have liked to see some more proof. Though, as I said, Saldo's comments are strong evidence that some kind of operation across the Dnieper is underway. But about other news, the other very big dramatic news that's playing out on the battlefronts. Well, as to that, there is much less doubt. And if we're talking about the situation in Zaporozhye specifically, I would say that there is no doubt realistically about this at all. And this concerns the village. It's actually a very big village, the village of Poltavka in southern Zaporozhye region, one of the three strong villages, strongly fortified villages that the Ukrainians have on this territory, the other two being Uspenovka and Velikomikhailovka, the latter a bit to the north. Anyway, there were reports yesterday that Poltavka had fallen, that the Russians have captured Poltavka. And today, the Russian Defense Ministry has confirmed that this is indeed the case. Poltavka, a large settlement in Zaporozhye region, has been liberated by SWAT detachments of the 57th Separate Motorized Rifle Brigade, assigned to the 5th Combined Army, Arms Army of the Vostok East Group of Forces. The assault was complicated as the servicemen had to cross a river. The river in question, by the way, is the Yanchor River. Had to cross a river on several sections of the front. Aviation, artillery, drones engaged the enemy by fire. The Russian troops liberated one of the largest settlements on the west bank of the Yanchor River. The enemy lost more than 12 square kilometres of prepared defence areas. Our troops mopped up more than 500 buildings. 500 buildings means a large community, a large village. Obviously, it's more than just a small number of houses or cottages. The East Group of Forces units continue to conduct operations against Ukrainian troops, pushing the enemy out of fortified positions and liberating Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk regions. Now, notice the words here. Liberating Zaporozhye and Dnipropetrovsk region. Now, Zaporozhye is, of course, one of the four regions that held referendums, Russian-conducted referendums, in September 2022, and which, according to the Russian constitution, are now an integral part of the Russian Federation. So when the Russian Defense Ministry says that the Russians are liberating Zaporozhye region, that is, in some respects, an uncontroversial thing to say, though in some other respects it is nonetheless still an interesting and important thing to say, for reasons I will come to later in this program. But so far, the Russians do not claim that Dnipropetrovsk region is a part of Russia. There's been no Russian organized referendum in Dnipropetrovsk region. Officially, the Russian government continues to treat Dnipropetrovsk region as a part of Ukraine. And yet we see that the Russian Defense Ministry claims that its forces are liberating it. So that strongly implies that at the back of someone's mind in Moscow, and by someone, I can't help but think that must be at the very least the Russian General Staff, at the back of their minds, Dnipropetrovsk region also is Russian and destined eventually to become part of Russia. When we discuss the diplomacy that is now taking place, I will return to this topic later in this program. Anyway, Poltavka, the capture of Poltavka, is important in itself, because if you look at the map of these three villages, Poltavka, Uspenovka, and Velikomikhailovka, well, Velikomikhailovka to the north is an isolated settlement, but Uspenovka and Poltavka are closely interconnected. The Russians are now west of the Yanchor River. It seems impossible to me that the Ukrainians will be able to defend Uspenovka for very long. Probably the Ukrainians will be forced to abandon Uspenovka within the next few days, because if they don't, their troops will be trapped there and to no useful purpose. And that leaves the Russians, the way open for the Russians to advance westwards, to cut the supply road leading from the north southward towards the key city of Guliapolye, one of the three cities or towns that the Ukrainians still control in Zaporozhye region. The other two being Orekhov and Zaporozhye city itself. And most people who have studied this conflict, and anybody, by the way, who looks at a map, I think would be forced to agree that if the Ukrainians lose Gulyapolye, because the supplies are cut off, and bear in mind, the Russians are just outside Gulyapolye already, their forces are stationed immediately to the south of Gulyapolye, and to some extent to the west of it. If the Ukrainians lose Gulyapolye, with the Russians located both to the west and to the east and to the south of Orekhov, it will be all but impossible for the Ukrainians to defend Orekhov as well. And that will open the way for the Russians to occupy the entirety of Zaporozhye region, apart from the city of Zaporozhye itself. And that, again, also might have an important bearing on the diplomacy going forward. So this is big news, and there's no doubt at all that this has happened. There were already claims yesterday, based on video footage, that Boltavka had been captured by the Russians. The Russian Defense Ministry has now confirmed the fact, and there is really no question about it. The defense of Zaporozhye region is crumbling, and the Russian forces are pushing towards the Dnieper, and it looks an almost irresistible advance. It would require a massive redeployment of Ukrainian troops to Zaporozhye region to hold the front lines there. And to be frank, given the pressure that the Ukrainians are in lots of other places, I myself doubt that it can be done. Anyway, that's Zaporozhye region. The other place where we have had dramatic news is perhaps the most important of all, and it is, of course, Pokrovsk. Now, here, again, it's important to say that this is all based mostly on reports from Russian sources. There is still a dearth of video footage, but the reports that are now circulating are starting to pile up and to reinforce each other. And video footage did appear yesterday from an area of Pokrovsk that Russian reports had previously said that the Russians had captured. And the video footage confirmed that those claims were true. And the latest reports appear to build up on the momentum of that, and I suspect that they are also true. Now, briefly, what these reports suggest is that there is a withdrawal, a retreat taking place, that all Ukrainian troops in southern Pokrovsk, south of the railway line, are trying to retreat into northern Pokrovsk, beyond the railway line, that the Russians have captured the entirety of central Pokrovsk, that there are only a few places at the far eastern edge of Pokrovsk where there is still a Ukrainian presence, but that the Ukrainians are likely to pull out of that territory also. And on the railway lines, there are reports, these reports also say, that the Russians have captured the railway station, which is a major position, right in the centre of Pokrovsk, and that their drones are now operating regularly above the railway lines, making it very difficult for the Ukrainian troops from the south to cross to the north of Pokrovsk without being attacked by the Russian drones. Now, this is dramatic news, and it appears to be connected to events that are happening slightly further to the east, to the capture recently by the Russians, or the completion by the Russians of the capture of an important village called Novopavlivka and of some territory around it and of certain fortified positions around it, and to reports that the Russians were going to advance north from Novopavlivka to try to cut Ukrainian forces defending the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd conurbation in two, to, in other words, divide the Ukrainian forces in Pokrovsk. Now, to be clear, if the Ukrainians retreat from southern Pokrovsk, the whole of Pokrovsk south of the railway lines, that does not mean that Pokrovsk has been fully captured by the Russians. I suspect that it does mean that the Russians will control the main administrative buildings in the centre of Pokrovsk and most of the residential areas, but there is still quite a lot of Pokrovsk located north of the railway lines. But to say quite straightforwardly, I think that it's not going to be possible for the Ukrainians to defend this area of Pokrovsk north of the railway lines for very long either. This is because the Russians control all of the supply roads leading into Pokrovsk, either directly because their troops are stationed on them, and this perhaps is the case. And in any event, again, their drones dominate the skies above these supply roads so that supplies can't reach the Ukrainians in the quantity that is needed to hold any part of Pokrovsk for very long. And the other thing is that if the Ukrainians retreat, if they abandon southern Pokrovsk, that is going to make it extraordinarily difficult for the Ukrainians to defend their positions further east in Mirnograd either. The Ukrainians in Mirnograd would in effect be surrounded by the Russians on three sides, and they would still be at risk of being cut off completely if the Russians do push north from Novopavlivka and capture the territory between Pokrovsk itself and Mirnograd. It is highly likely that at some point over the next couple of days, the Ukrainians will want to withdraw from Mirnograd as well. Frankly, if the information about the situation in Pokrovsk is true, if the Ukrainians are indeed retreating to the areas north of the railway lines, then the fall of Mirnograd must happen probably within days or at most weeks, more logically days than weeks. So one way or the other, we are now entering what looks to me to be the last stage of the battle for Pokrovsk, a complex and very difficult battle, one that bears some resemblance to other battles that the Russians have fought for the capture of towns. Perhaps the closest parallel would be the battles for Selidovo and Kurakhovo, which took place last year. But a battle which, in my opinion, has played out much more rapidly than had seemed likely at one time. Anyway, I have discussed in many programmes the crisis the Ukrainians will face, when Pokrovsk falls, which is now inevitable, that the Russians will be able to cut off and surround Konstantinivka. And on that front, the Russians claim now that fighting is indeed taking place inside Konstantinivka, that the fighting is extremely intense inside Konstantinovka itself, but the Ukrainians still have supply routes to Konstantinovka from the north through the town of Druzhivka. But if Pokrovsk falls, those supply lines are now in jeopardy, especially given that the Russians are also present on the other side, the eastward side of Konstantinovka, through their control of Chasiv Yar. So Konstantinovka would become undefendable, but then logically, so would Slavyansk and Kramatorsk before long too. That both of these two towns, the last two important towns that the Ukrainians would, after the fall of Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka, still hold in Donbass, those two towns would be outflanked by the Russians from the west, advancing from Pokrovsk. And as I've discussed in several programs now, we are now looking at an actual, probable Donbass cauldron. And incidentally, even as I'm making this program, I've just seen a report flash up on TASS, and it's comes from Alexander Drobotov, deputy commander of the assault battalion of the 55th Separate Guards Motorized Rifle Brigade of Group of Forces Center, the group of forces that is currently storming Pokrovsk. Most unusual, by the way, almost unheard of, for a regular army Russian military officer involved in actual operations to provide information to the Russian media. And we're talking, by the way, here, the official Russian media. TASS is the official Russian news agency. Anyway, Drobotov has just told TASS the two settlements, Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, are isolated from each other. The unified defense system the Ukrainians have in the Pokrovsk agglomeration is being torn apart. So Drobotov is saying that the Russians have already, in effect, cut Mirnograd and Pokrovsk off from each other, and that their unified command, that the unified nature of their forces has already collapsed. So this information from an actual Russian battlefield commander whose men are participating in the battle appears to corroborate the reports about the collapse of Ukrainian defenses south of the railway lines in Pokrovsk. He appears to be confirming it is true, with all of the implications that I have just said. Anyway, to repeat again, this is not the only fighting where events on the battlefields is now playing out disastrously for Ukraine. There were reports circulating yesterday that Russian troops have broken into the town of Liman, which is located further north to the west of Slavyansk. Slavyansk being now the northernmost town in Donbass, which is still under Ukrainian control. Slavyansk is an important town, and it is one that the Russians absolutely do want and need to recapture if they are going to finish the battle, the wider, bigger battle for Donbass. Now, the interesting fact about these reports about the Russians breaking into Liman is that they're not coming from the Russians, they're coming from the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are saying that even though the battle for Yampol, big village to the east of Liman, lying between Liman and Siversk, that though this battle has not yet ended, a Russian force has pushed through wooded territory and has infiltrated, as they put it, into Liman itself. It's not clear whether we're talking about sabotage and reconnaissance groups or whether we're talking about a proper motorized rifle, regular troops of the Russian army in proper military formations breaking into Liman. But it does look as if the Russians have established at least a presence in Liman, though no doubt the Ukrainians will try to counterattack and will try to push them out. And that does, again, emphasize how critical the situation here is. And the Russians continue, according to their reports, to storm the villages of Yampol, of which they claim to control around two-thirds, and the village of Dronovka, of which I believe they claim now to capture around, to control around half. And of course, the Russians also say that fighting is going on in Siversk as well, though they admit that the Ukrainians in Siversk are putting up a fierce resistance and are still just about able to get supplies through the road leading into Siversk from the west. And no doubt that they will still be able to do that until the villages of Dronovka and Yampol finally fall. Anyway, I'm not going to get into details about these battles, but this is what we're hearing, that the Russians are now in Liman. And further north still, in Kupiansk, smaller town than Slavyansk, Kupiansk, by the way, is in Kharkiv region, not in Donbass, there are reports that Ukrainian organized Ukrainian defense in Kupiansk, in eastern Kupiansk, east of the Oskol River, is starting to break down. That the men who are resisting the Russians there are now desperately short of supplies. The Russians hold the West Bank. They hold the residential area of Kupiansk on the West Bank. This part of Kupiansk, which the Russians control, is on higher ground than the part of Kupiansk still under Ukrainian control, on lower ground, on the East Bank. And of course, the Russians anyway dominate the East Bank of the Oskol River. And there is no satisfactory way for supplies to get through to these Ukrainian troops, and there are no clear escape routes for them either. And again, it's been suggested that the Ukrainian resistance in this area east of the Oskol River might collapse within the next few days. So this is the military situation, as best as I can reconstruct it, as it appears now. Over the last 24 hours, we've seen that the Russian Defense Ministry has itself confirmed the capture of Poltavka in Zaporozhye region. Saldo, the governor of Kherson region, is confirming or claiming, and what he claims, since he is the governor of the region, carries weight, is claiming that the Russians have crossed the Dnieper and are fighting inside the boundary areas of the city of Kherson. And we have seen that a Russian military officer, Alexander Drobotov, deputy commander of the assault battalion of the 55th Separate Guards Motorized Rifle Brigade of Group of Forces Center, appears to confirm that there is now a collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, that the Ukrainian forces in these two places have been divided from each other. And this also in turn appears to lend weight to the Russian claims that there is a mass and rather chaotic retreat going on, that Ukrainian troops are trying to escape from southern Pokrovsk across the railways to the north, and it is likely that they will try to evacuate Mirnograd also over the course of the next couple of days. So anyway, that is the information that we're getting, and it is important to keep all of this in mind in light of the ongoing saga of the very complicated negotiations between the Americans and the Russians, purportedly to end the war. And it's very difficult, by the way, to understand in some respects what these negotiations between the Americans and the Russians, what actual structure and logic they follow. Because the Americans and the Russians are both maintaining the fiction, a fiction which is politically convenient to both, that they are negotiating with each other to end the war, and that this is a war purely between Ukraine and Russia. That the United States is and has at various times lent support to Ukraine, provided Ukraine with a certain amount of military assistance. But in fact, this is actually a war between Ukraine and Russia. It is not a conflict between Russia and the United States. Now, this is very strange because, as I pointed out earlier in this program, US officers, military officers, have been deeply involved in the war. They have, as the New York Times has told us, commanded Ukrainian offensives, the one in Kherson region in the autumn of 2022, which I discussed earlier in this program, the one against the Russians in Kharkiv region in the summer of 2022, the summer and early autumn of 2022. And that, by the way, for me, was the most important offensive that Ukraine has conducted. It is the only offensive where I think one can be justified as saying that the Ukrainians did win a clear-cut victory, even if they didn't achieve all of the things that they tried to do. But anyway, the Americans were heavily involved in planning and commanding that. And as has been widely confirmed, including by the New York Times, the Americans commanded, basically ran, Ukraine's summer 2023 counteroffensive towards the Black Sea and the Azov Sea, a counteroffensive which failed utterly. And it has been largely confirmed that the British played a very similar role with a completely catastrophic operation across the Dnieper, which the Ukrainians tried to carry out in the winter of 2023-2024, which ended disastrously in the village of Kyrenki. So all of this is not just a case of the United States providing help to Ukraine. It is of the United States, in effect, participating directly in a war against Russia. And it has conducted that war in other ways as well. It provides intelligence to Ukraine. It provides targeting data to Ukraine since at least July, as was recently confirmed. The United States has been helping Ukraine to conduct drone attacks on Russian positions, including oil refineries deep inside Russia. The United States has also assisted Ukraine to conduct missile strikes, not just in the new territories, as the Russians would call them, the four regions and Crimea, but in pre-2014 Russia as well. And of course, they've recently been talking about supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine and conducting deep strikes pretty much across Russia using these missiles. So, as US Secretary of State Marco Rubio once admitted, this is at the very least a proxy war between Russia and the United States. And I personally, as I've said many times, would go much further than that. I would say that this isn't a proxy war. It is better understood as yet another coalition war in which the United States and its allies are waging a coalition war against Russia, with Ukraine as one member of this coalition, providing most of the infantry, but with other members of the coalition, including the United States, participating in all sorts of ways. So, to me, the simplest and most straightforward way to negotiate an end to the war would be for the two major powers that are involved in fighting this war with each other, which is to say the United States and Russia, to negotiate directly with each other about it. That, after all, is what happened during the conflict in Vietnam, and it is also what happened during the conflict in Afghanistan. But no, that's not what the United States wants to do. The Russians and the Americans preserve the pretense that the Americans and the Russians are not negotiating directly, that it is the Ukrainians who must be participants in the negotiation and who must negotiate with the Russians. The United States instead supposedly is using its good offices as a mediator in order to broker a mutually satisfactory compromise that will end the war. Now, to my mind, this is the underlying problem in the negotiations, because the Americans and the Russians, perhaps left to themselves, might be able to come to a satisfactory compromise if they were negotiating directly with each other. But they have given the wild card in this battle, President Zelensky and Ukraine. Well, they're treating it not just as the wild card, but the Americans are treating it as the trump card, which can stop and block the whole game. And we have seen this play out again over the last 24 hours. Now, there are reports in the US media, the Washington Post especially, but in other sections of the media as well, that over the course of the telephone call between Trump and Putin, and by the way, I believe that there have been two calls, Larry Johnson, who the former intelligence officer who is the author of Sonar 21, one of the best blogs covering this war in existence. Anyway, Larry Johnson has recently been in Russia and he's had discussions with people who know things in Russia from the inside. And whilst I absolutely do not believe Reuters or Moscow Times or all, any of these people when they claim that they are able to speak to insiders in Russia. I don't believe that any genuine insiders in Russia would have anything to do with outlets like that. In the case of Larry Johnson, I absolutely do believe that the Russians would indeed speak to him and that he is indeed talking to exactly the kind of insiders that he says and that the information he's getting from them is reliable. Anyway, Larry Johnson has said that the 2.5 hour telephone conversation that took place several days ago between Putin and Trump, the one which Alex and I have discussed on the Duran and which I have discussed extensively in this programme, the one of which Ushakov, Putin's aide, has provided us with a detailed briefing and which Trump talked about in his Truth Social post. Anyway, that 2.5 hour conversation has been only one of several that Trump and Putin have had over the last couple of weeks, and that there has been at least one other, one which took place on the day of Putin's birthday, the day when Putin, by the way, was in St. Petersburg, meeting the generals there and talking to them about potential Odessa operations, and was hosting them on a tour of the Peter and Paul Fortress and Cathedral and showing to them the tombs of Peter the Great and Catherine the Great. Well, apparently Trump telephoned Putin on that day also with the purpose, the overt purpose presumably, of congratulating Putin on his birthday. But the entire conversation quickly evolved into a conversation about the conflict in Ukraine, over the course of which Putin expressed his frustration that Trump had not come back to him over whatever it was that they agreed to discuss, that they agreed with each other or had agreed to discuss further at their summit in Alaska. And this conversation apparently lasted a full 40 minutes. And there might have been others, which we don't know about also. So anyway, the Washington Post says that over the course of a conversation, a telephone conversation between Putin and Trump, and we might be talking about the last conversation, the one we know about, but there may have been other ones too. Putin allegedly again reiterated that he might be willing or would be willing to agree a ceasefire on the existing front lines in Kherson and Zaporozhye, but that he insisted upon a Ukrainian withdrawal entirely from Donbass. Now, I have discussed this in many programs, and I said a number of things. Firstly, I said that given that the Russians spend a great deal of time at the Anchorage summit meeting explaining to Trump that there could not be a ceasefire unless and until there was a full negotiated resolution of the conflict, it did seem to me somewhat illogical that the Russians would either propose or agree a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass. Having said that, I've also said, and said on many occasions, that I could see that this might be something which Putin, in August of this year, a couple of months ago, might have been prepared to run with, and might still be prepared to run with, or perhaps might have been prepared to run with a week ago, or a month ago, or at any rate until very recently. The conflict, after all, the present conflict began in Donbass. The Russians gained control of Crimea in 2014, but the fall of Crimea to Russia did not lead to an armed conflict between Ukraine and Russia. What has caused the crisis to spiral, and what has triggered strong reactions from the Western powers and indeed an attempted economic siege of Russia, has been the crisis that developed in the spring of 2014 in Donbass. There were protests in Donbass in spring of 2014 when the constitutionally and democratically elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, who is from Donbass, was overthrown as a result of the violent events that took place in Kiev in February 2014, the events that Putin and the Russians refer to as the Maidan coup. There was then Ukraine's disastrous decision to launch what it called an anti-terrorism operation in Donbass in the spring and summer of 2014. That led to the Ukrainian defeat in 2014, in the summer of 2014, and a subsequent Ukrainian defeat in February 2015, which led to the Minsk Agreement. And the Minsk Agreement was never honoured by Ukraine, and that led to the current crisis, eventually the one that began in February 2022 with the start of the special military operation. Putin cares about Donbass. So do a lot of Russians. Donbass was the place that resisted the Ukrainian what they call the Ukrainian regime, the Kiev regime. Donbass is the place where the fighting has taken place. Putin has repeatedly said that Russia will never allow Ukraine to roll over Donbass. And in February 2022, the special military operation was launched specifically to protect Donbass, which in February 2022, Putin and Russia recognized as independent. So I can imagine, given the centrality of Donbass to this whole conflict, that the Russians would agree to cease fire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which they care about less, provided the Ukrainians withdraw from the whole of Donbass and provided all of the other elements that the Russians thought they had agreed with the Ukrainians in Istanbul in April 2022 were put into effect. No NATO membership for Ukraine, first and foremost, but rights for Russian speakers elsewhere in Ukraine, denuclearization, demilitarization, denazification, all of those things that the Russians talk about. Well, so I was not party to the discussions between Putin and Witkoff. I was not present at over the course of the conversations between Putin and Trump in Anchorage. I have not been listening in to the conversations that have taken place between Putin and Trump since then. But if it has been suggested at various times or even proposed that Russia cease fire or stop on the existing front lines in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided there is a Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbass, well, it would not shock or surprise me, though, to be clear, at any time, it would be controversial in Russia. Well, anyway, The Washington Post says that this is what Putin brought up again over the course of his conversation, his telephone conversation with Trump. This idea that the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass and that there be a ceasefire in other places and then that the parties move forward quickly with the rest of Istanbul Plus. Well, as I said, it could be that that was what Putin proposed to Trump. And the Washington Post says that there are some people within the Trump administration who think that this is not an unreasonable demand or one that the United States should set its face against as a means to end the war. Witkoff, in particular, is supposed to have spoken out strongly in favour of it. But the problem is that the Ukrainians, Zelensky, continues to set his face completely against it. And over the last 24 hours, reports in the European media confirmed that the Europeans are supporting Zelensky in this. They're saying that there must not be any withdrawal by the Ukrainians anywhere at all. That the only acceptable outcome, the only acceptable compromise, is of a freeze of the conflict. A complete freeze of the conflict. Never mind about the rest of Istanbul Plus or anything like that. A complete freeze of the conflict on the existing lines. Something which the Russians have repeatedly made clear is unacceptable to them. Now, this is where we come back to what I said, that the wild card, which is Zelensky and Ukraine, in terms of the progress of the negotiations, has been allowed to become the Trump card, or if you like, the veto card. Because Trump might think that what Putin is proposing is perfectly reasonable. At least that's what we've been told. Or some of his officials might, and that perhaps more accurately is what we are being told. But if Trump and these reasonable people, these people who think this is reasonable within his administration, are not prepared to face down Zelensky on this issue and the Europeans on this issue and the other hardliners who support them within the United States government, then this plan of ending the war by the Ukrainians withdrawing from Donbass simply will not happen. Now, what makes this all extraordinary? And what perhaps places a vast question mark over peace is that, as we have seen, since that proposal was first allegedly made, either by Putin or by Witkoff in their discussions in August of this year, the situation on the battlefronts has changed. The Russians are on the brink of capturing Pokrovsk. The news that we've had today all but confirms the fact. They're now fighting inside Liman as well, and all of the indications are that Siversk is going to fall and the situation in Kupiansk, close to Slavyansk, is close to collapse. So what might have been an acceptable compromise in August, at least an attractive compromise, one which Putin might be able to sell to his Security Council in August, might not look so attractive now. Bear in mind that we've also now had information about the situation in those other places where the Russians supposedly back in August were saying that they might be prepared to cease fire. The Russians are now in Kherson City. That is what Saldo, the governor of Kherson region, is telling us. Maybe he's wrong, but there's a lot of information that suggests that he is right. The Russian army has captured Poltavka and is likely to be weeks, but not more than weeks, away from capturing Guliapolye as well. Zaporozhye, which in August might have looked far away, no longer looks so far. So if Putin comes back to Moscow from, say, Budapest and says, look, this is the deal that we are agreeing with Trump, the Ukrainians quit Donbass and we stop in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, there will be some people inevitably in Russia who will come back and say, why are we doing this? We're going to capture Donbass, the whole of Donbass. It's no longer so much a matter of time, because that time is almost running out. In a few weeks, few months at most, we're going to have it all. And why are we stopping in Zaporozhye and Kherson City when Zaporozhye City is just coming over the horizon and we are already fighting inside Kherson City? What is being proposed here? That we retreat again from Kherson City? That we divide Kherson City with the Ukrainians? That we hold on to the industrial territory that we control on the West Bank and the Ukrainians still control the residential area? How does that make sense? One could see how a proposal that might have appeared attractive in August might not appear so attractive or acceptable in Moscow in October now. Now, if we look at things from the Russian side, we've also seen that Dmitry Medvedev, the man who has positioned himself as Russia's most outspoken hardliner, has now made certain comments ahead of the potential meeting between Putin and Trump. Now, Medvedev has been out of the picture over the last, actually, rather turbulent 10 days. He's been far away in Pyongyang, where he's had a whole succession of extremely friendly meetings with Kim Jong-un. And he has managed to further consolidate what is now clearly the alliance, the emerging alliance between Russia and North Korea. But of course, being away in Pyongyang has made it much more difficult for him to involve himself in the discussions that are taking place in Moscow. Anyway, Medvedev has now come back to Moscow, and returning to Moscow, he has again published one of those astonishing posts that he publishes every so often on his Telegram channels and on X. And this time, I'm going to read it out. Though maybe I will water down his language in one or two places. During his meeting with the tearful beggar is, of course, Zelensky, Trump said something obvious yet interesting. Let Russia and Ukraine both declare themselves winners. That kind of compromise sometimes happens after wars, but not in this case. It's not just that Russia seeks victory on clearly defined terms. That's a given. The problem is that the current clique in Kiev can never be seen as victorious at home, that's to say in Ukraine, under any circumstances. And then he uses an extremely crude expressions to describe Zelensky, which I'm not going to repeat. But let's say Zelensky and his cronies know this perfectly well. Losing territory will never be forgiven, not by the nationalists, nor by political rivals. For them, the end of the war means the end of the regime. That's why Trump's formula doesn't apply here. Still, the self-proclaimed peacemaker, that's Trump, notice that he's not being terribly positive about Trump. Still, the self-proclaimed peacemaker played his tomahawk diplomacy card well, stirring global opinion in his usual style. He wrapped it up in classic fashion, hinting at the dispatch of nuclear submarines before jokingly admitting, "Sorry, brother, we need them ourselves." This is rich irony, because Trump previously, in response to something that Medvedev said, said that he had deployed nuclear submarines closer to Russia, and the Russians have concluded that that never happened. By the way, the Indian Foreign Ministry has apparently also now formally confirmed that the telephone conversation between Trump and Modi, at which Modi supposedly told Trump that India was going to stop buying Russian oil, that that conversation actually never happened either. I haven't been following the website of the Indian Foreign Ministry recently, so it may be that I'm overstating things there. But anyway, what Medvedev is saying here is that Trump's tomahawk diplomacy was all unreal. It was all bluff. It was a bluff he played with some skill, just as his bluff about the submarines, the nuclear submarines, was also in its way skillful. But it was empty. It was all a threat with no substance. But then Medvedev goes on to say, to his credit, Trump remains firm in his stance. It's not my war. The senile fool, that's of course Biden, is to blame. Even the fool, however, was against sending long-range weapons to the Kiev regime. But this, of course, won't stop the ongoing flow of new arms to Kiev. The story isn't over, and we must be ready for whatever comes next. Now, let me repeat again, before I say what I'm going to say, that Medvedev is not mounting a political challenge to Vladimir Putin. I have been reading far too much recently about a supposed plans for a coup, a palace plot, an intrigue against Putin. There are lots of indicators when a power struggle of that kind is happening in Russia, and to repeat again, I see none of them. Medvedev is totally loyal to Putin, as all of the other members of the Russian elite are. And just to add a further point, the last time that the Russian elite would ever think of launching a palace coup or a plot against the leader would be in a time of war and crisis, such as the one that Russia is in at the moment. The very last thing they would want is to telegraph instability right across Russia to every part of Russia's political nation and to the world at large by acting to oust the country's massively popular and internationally highly respected leader. So, I mean, any idea of a political coup or a power struggle in the Kremlin in Russia at this time needs to be put completely to one side. But what Medvedev is doing here, and I think if you read his words carefully, is he is essentially setting out the limits for what Putin can do when he meets with Trump. He says, look, you can negotiate with Trump. I'm not saying that you can't, but be very, very clear about this. The only acceptable way for the war to end is for us to win and for Zelensky and for his people to lose. And when we say lose, we mean lose in a way that even they cannot in any way dispute and deny. Because what we want is not just some territory or promises about NATO or things of that kind. What we want ultimately is the end of the entire regime. And as for the Americans, as for Trump himself, don't trust him. Yes, he is very clever at playing games of bluff, as he did with the Tomahawks, and before that with the nuclear submarines. But these ultimately are empty threats, and we should not be unduly concerned about them. The reality is the ongoing flow of new arms to Kiev. The story isn't over, and we must be ready for whatever comes next. So Medvedev is signalling, and he's signalling, I have no doubt about this, on behalf of a significant section of the political elite in Moscow, that there must not be significant fundamental concessions to the Americans or to the Ukrainians in Budapest. Now, I've no doubt that Putin is aware of this and that Putin takes all of this heavily into account. Yesterday, Putin again met his Security Council, of which, of course, Medvedev is vice chairman. And I believe, in fact, I am sure that Medvedev was there, that he actually participated in that discussion. Now, the Kremlin, as always, gives us very few, very limited information as to what exactly was discussed over the course of this meeting. But, and we're told that it was all basically about mineral resources on the seabed and all of those things. But I cannot imagine that some of these points were not discussed. And though Medvedev's name, I just checked, does not appear on the list of attendees of this meeting, I'm fairly sure that others who were participating on this meeting, maybe Shoigu, maybe Vivanov, maybe other officials, the intelligence officials, they will share Medvedev's views. And of course, Medvedev will be attending future meetings of the Security Council when they take place. So, Putin has to take these opinions into account and will take these opinions into account. He cannot govern Russia effectively without the support of the Security Council. And that will affect the stance that he's taking in Budapest. Time has been lost since Anchorage. The situation on the ground, because it has moved so far in Russia's favour, makes it more difficult, probably, for Putin to continue with possible concessions he might have made over territory in Anchorage. And the fundamental problem anyway remains that Zelensky and the Europeans remain adamantly opposed to any compromise at all. How this circle is going to be squared, I have to say this, I am unable myself to see. And, well, I'm also going to come back to that comment by the Russian Defense Ministry about capturing, liberating Dniepropetrovsk region. Because, of course, if the Russians continue to advance in Kharkiv region and Dniepropetrovsk region and all of these places, given that, according to the military, they are liberating these places, how can they return them back? Perhaps they can now, but if the whole of Dniepropetrovsk region, or significant parts of it, if most of Kharkiv region, or significant parts of it, fall under Russian control over the next few weeks and months, which is starting to look more and more possible, how do the Russians explain to themselves, given that they say that they're liberating this territory, that they're giving it back? And I'm going to say what I also think. I think that even if the Russians capture the whole of Donbass and reach the Dnieper and take the whole of Dniepropetrovsk region and take much of Kharkiv region, personally, I still am of the view that Zelensky and his people in Kiev and the Europeans will continue to resist calls for compromise. They will still reject any proposals for a negotiated settlement. Because, as Medvedev says, if Zelensky agrees terms which would be seen as a defeat in Kiev, he is toast politically, and the Europeans don't want a negotiation with Russia because their whole policy is indefinite conflict with Russia in order to keep the Americans in Europe. So, for the moment at least, and I don't want to sound unduly bleak, but for the moment at least, I don't really see the prospects of change. Now, I said that there are none of the telltale signs of a power struggle in Moscow that one would expect to see if such a power struggle was actually taking place. But you can argue that a power struggle, such signs are there in Ukraine, oddly enough. Zelensky, over the last couple of weeks, seems to be taking further steps to purge regional officials who are not directly under his control. He has just acted to remove from his position the long-standing mayor of Odessa, a man called Tukhanov, who has played an extraordinarily complicated and intricate role in balancing and retaining his position in the shifting, endlessly shifting sands of Ukrainian politics. The Ukrainian intelligence agencies claim that he has joint Russian and Ukrainian citizenship. They've published photos of what they say is his Russian passport. A number of people have pointed out that this Russian passport is a crude forgery and clearly isn't issued by the Russian authorities. I noticed that one celebrated agency in the West, I'm not going to name it, is trying to claim that it was the Russians who forged this passport in order to discredit Tukhanov, which is an absurd idea. Why would the Russians, if they were planning to do that, produce a forgery of a document of which they make the authentic versions themselves? It doesn't make sense. If they wanted to embarrass Tukhanov, they could just have published or produced or circulated an actual authentic Russian passport, meeting all the criteria of a Russian passport in his name. But anyway, I'm not going to waste time on these absurd theories that some people come up with. Anyway, the point is that Zelensky is clearly carrying out another purge of local mayors and people of that kind. And I have little doubt that this is intended eventually to lead up to the ousting of the mayor of Kiev, Vitali Klitschko, who Zelensky sees as a rival. In the case of the mayor of Odessa, I think probably Zelensky has also been rattled by information about the Russian plan to advance across the Dnieper to Odessa itself, the one that Putin discussed with the generals in St. Petersburg about 10 days ago, and he wants somebody completely reliable and whom he can trust in charge of Odessa in case something like that happens. And quite rightly, he doesn't trust the current mayor, rather the previous mayor, to be that person. But anyway, you could see signs of power struggle in Ukraine. And you will see more of them, by the way, over the next couple of months. But to be clear, it is a power struggle that Zelensky is winning. You see no such signs in Russia. That doesn't preclude debate and argument taking place there, which of course it is, and we can see. And this is the important thing to take away, that the political space for compromise is narrowing, principally because of events on the battlefields. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.